Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Marco Sippi.
On today's programme, we'll be learning the food story of Morocco, courtesy of writer Narjis Benghabou. She just released her new book, Casablanca, My Moroccan Food, and we'll be stopping by to talk a bit about it.
We'll also be hearing from Texas-born talent Josh T. Pearson. The musician will be discussing his latest record, The Straight Hits, later on in the programme.
And we'll be discussing some of the best music festivals ever to ruin a perfectly good field in years gone by, and why radio DJ Matt Everett and illustrator Jim Stoughton have chosen to document some of them in cartoon form for their new book Where's My Welly?
That's all to come, plus Monocle's own main stage headliner Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today. And we'll play you some new music too, here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Tom, what a week it's been. And here we are again on a Sunday.
It's a lovely, sunny week. Or it has been here in London town. You never know where you are with May. It can be a bit inclement, but it's been beautiful.
I was just going to say that I think it's been my favourite week so far this year. Not bad at all. Sun's been shining, people have been jolly, and you definitely feel the difference in London in people's mood.
There's a feast, Marcus, of great items ahead for us.
Absolutely.
And shall we start with the starter course?
Which is a look ahead to the news events of the following 7 days. For that, we're joined by Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. A warm welcome to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He's hardly been asleep. Exactly.
He's been up all night. It was Eurovision last night.
I have to admit that I wasn't quite sure if you would even show up today, because I know how important Eurovision is for you, and I know that you probably stayed away till quite late partying and celebrating.
Sorry for my eye bags here. they're quite ugly looking, but no problem.
Let's play the tune of news this week. What have we got coming up, Fernando, for us?
First of all, I do hope it's going to be another very beautiful and sunny week. I agreed with what Marcus said earlier. I love when it's sunny, and it does change the mood. Talking about mood, you know, on the 14th of May, that's our first story of the day, 1 year since Macron's inauguration in France. And the reason why I choose, you know, I don't usually do that, 1 year inaugurations, but I think Macron was such a game changer in French politics. You know, for the first time, a guy who was not from one of the main center-right parties or center-left, you know, he just came, well, not out of nowhere. I mean, he had a career before.
Not as a public servant. He had been working, you know, behind the scenes, really.
Absolutely. So. And people say, you know, in the UK, they say, oh, we tried to do what Macron did and other countries are doing the same. But I have a feeling this was something unique in France. He was the man for last year in particular. So I don't think it would be replicated so easily in other countries.
Exactly. I think it's certainly been very interesting to follow Macron's path in the course of the last 12 months, how well he's been doing. Obviously, he's not quite as popular at the moment as he was in the very beginning. But at the same time, I think he's a great face for his country. Just looking at how he's been dealing with, say, Donald Trump. He is someone who actually dares to say something against Donald Trump and still, you know, find that friendly vibe with Trump, who may not be the easiest person to meet to discuss things.
Absolutely. And I think it just shows the power of political leadership. I think in our Show Midori House this week, there was a discussion with the guests saying, oh, shall we all have like a technocrat government who knows about everything? You know, even though there are some good aspects of that, I do think that people, when they vote, it's emotional. We need a figurehead. We need a charismatic figurehead. I think that's also very important. You know, if you have a good economic policy, even better. But we need that figurehead. I think that's very important. And if you have someone who I think is fairly good, like Macron, even though, as Marco said, he's not entirely popular in France at the moment. But yeah, just marking here 1 year since his inauguration in France.
Well, and it's been a very interesting 12 months. He certainly came in on a sort of real tidal wave of public support, and a lot of the big sort of systemic problems that France faces have perhaps caught up with him. But he seems to be answering them in fine style. And he's certainly putting a good face to the world, isn't he, on his sort of diplomatic global jaunts, glad handing everyone, even Donald Trump, etc., etc. What else has caught your eye, Fernando?
Well, let's go to London, actually. Our hometown here. It's Photo London, the fourth one. It's funny about Photo London. It's the biggest event about photography in the capital. And it's very recent, because before that, London had a few events here and there. But, you know, even though it's such a recent kind of type of event, it's already on the schedules. You know, if you're an art dealer, if you have a gallery, it's an event that you must come. And you know, they did that in a very short time. I think London was asking for it in a way.
I think that's a very positive thing, considering that even, it's quite astonishing, even today some people are questioning the value of photography as an art form.
Yes, which is an absurd in my opinion, because I think it's such a fantastic art form, and I would definitely be going there to Photo London. I think it will be between the 17th of May and the 21st at Somerset House, and it's the biggest ever so far. 101 galleries from 18 countries, from all over the place, you know, from Zurich to São Paulo, and they also invest in a lot of new photographers. There's a session of the event called Discovery.
Is there anything you find particularly interesting this time?
Well, I've been looking, not because I'm from São Paulo, but there's a lovely gallery called Casa Nova Arte e Cultura Contemporânea, which I know very well. And of course,
that was a catchy name. Do you want to say it again?
It's Casa Nova Arte e Cultura Contemporânea. Not very catchy, I'm sorry guys. But another one which we know, our neighbor, Atlas Gallery, they will be there as well.
In Finland we have this thing called Suomen valokuvataiteen museo.
Our photography
museum.
Would they be there for Photo London?
I would imagine so.
They're all welcome. Cosmopolitan as well. Doesn't London just need a bit of hands across the ocean at the moment?
I think London needs a little bit of Casanova Arte Cultura Contemporanea.
Everyone needs that. Come rain or shine, Fernando.
And Suomen valokuvataiteen museo.
Okay, stop showing off, you two. It's just called Photo London. That's out. Exactly. In English.
Exactly.
You can set your watch to that. What else is happening, Faye?
The final one, sorry, I'll keep it in-house, but I'm very excited about this, is the Monaco Spring Weekly. And the first Spring Weekly, actually, we had an experience with the Summer Weekly. So as you can imagine, the next 4 weeks here in the office will be fairly busy. But I did some contributions there in the paper, so it's very exciting.
So you find your own contributions very exciting?
I do find them, actually, very
exciting.
What
did you write?
Well, I wrote about magazines, sports magazines. You know, the World Cup is just a month to go.
What's your favourite sports magazine? Because I can't really, because normally I see you reading, you know, Vogue and, you know, kind of like style magazines and all that. What kind of sports magazine do you read? Do you read, I don't know, is there a magazine like Rugby World, the world of rugby?
There is actually a magazine called Rugby. And there's some nice
photos. We just talked about that on the stack in the last couple of weeks, Marcus.
Some nice photos in there.
Would they fit Photo London?
Maybe. Who knows?
If you're into that sort of thing. I like Ruler. Do you know that one? The cycling magazine.
That's a
They're always very beautiful. Howler is one of my favourite soccer titles.
I've got this thing about sports magazines. I'm trying to read them every now and then, but it's kind of like it's such a niche sometimes. I'm always wondering about the editorial meetings. How can you come up with new stuff, say, about running to fill 80 pages every month? I think that's astonishing as an art form of
Marcus,
its
you've
own.
Marcus, you've been churning out the menu on Monaco 24 for about 5 years, and it's still fresh as a new French cheese.
Well, you need dedication.
Wait, by the way, Spring Weekly, Tong, you have a column there as well.
What have you written about?
Come on.
What's to look out for here on Monaco 24, aside from the Monaco Weekly?
Oh, I can't wait to read that.
Get your copy. I think it's the 17th on Thursday.
Can I just say that I've been writing for Spring Weekly as well.
Oh, wow. What have you been writing?
About my youth and Finnish libraries.
Oh, it's a historical piece.
It's in the final pages of the magazine. It's about the great Finnish library system.
Oh.
Every base covered. Get your copy of the Monaco Spring Weekly. In the meantime, on the Monaco Weekly, thanks to Fernando Gustav Pacheco. Now, some of the best cooks and food writers come to the table via unconventional routes. And our first guest today is Nargis Benkaboo, a Belgian talent who left academia behind a few years ago to start blogging about the dishes of her parents' home country of Morocco.
Her blog, My Moroccan Food, has now led to a book, Casablanca, and she joins us now to talk us through it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Nargis. So, could you start by giving us a bit of background? What has your relationship been with Moroccan food?
It's a big part of my life because, you know, as you mentioned, Tom, I was born in Brussels, but my parents are from Morocco. And I think they used food as a medium to keep us connected to our roots. So at home, we ate Moroccan food for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner. It was a big part of our lives. Up to now, it's something that I've kept and that I've maintained because I just love it. And at home, food is a big part of our life because we're big foodies, like in many, many households. But my parents are very obsessed with food and my brothers. So I guess that's where it came from.
Could you tell us about the moment when you got some kind of a wake-up call? You moved to London to study politics, if I remember correctly, and then all of a sudden you realize that actually food is your thing.
Yeah, I think it's something I had in the back of my head for many years while I was studying politics. As soon as I left my parents' place, I started cooking on my own. Because I used to cook with my mom, but I was never really in charge of cooking for other people until I left my home. So that's when I realized that I was not bad at cooking. And all my friends, you know, kept telling me, you should do something about it. And my career was, you know, supposed to be completely different. And I was very passionate about what I studied. And I studied women's rights in the Middle East, and I really wanted to work in that field. And I think it just never really happened in London. I kept applying for jobs, and I ended up doing something completely different. So I just thought, maybe I should follow my dreams and you know, try cooking and go to cooking school and see what happens. And also I could see that people love Morocco as a destination. In the UK, people love to go to Marrakesh. They love Fez and Casablanca. They know all these places. But I also noticed that they were not familiar with the food, and it bothered me a little bit. I thought maybe I should do something about it. And that's when I had the idea to start my blog.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm one of those people, I guess. I've been to Marrakesh a couple of times, and I love the food that I enjoy there. But I guess there's still this perception, certainly in Britain, that, you know, I've had a tagine, so is that all there is to know about Moroccan food?
Did you consider bringing your chips with you?
No, we don't just eat chips. Marcus hails from Finland, still thinks we just eat purely potatoes all year round. But has that been part of the mission, if you like, to make people realise that it's so much more than just that?
Yeah, I think it's so much more than just that. And it's also much easier than what you think. All the ingredients that you need to make Moroccan food are accessible in the smallest supermarket you can find in England. And it's also something that people didn't know. And I think they confuse it with other Middle Eastern cuisines or North African. And while other cuisines are also beautiful, Moroccan cuisine has its own way, you know, to exist. And I also wanted to make a difference and tell people, you know, there's so much to know about Moroccan food. And I think the reason why people don't know that, I think, because I've been thinking about that a lot, I think it's because of the language barrier. Because French people know Moroccan cuisine, because there's a big Moroccan community in France, for instance, or in Belgium. And when they go to Morocco, they can ask questions, and they know what's in the tagine, and they know what the food is cooked with. Whereas here, because of the language barrier, they don't, you know, you can't really ask so many questions when you go to Marrakesh. You just eat the food, and it's nice, and then you come back home, and you think it's something exotic, and you don't know what it is. I think maybe it's one of the reasons why it's not as mainstream as other cuisines.
Don't you think that Morocco as a country should do more to try to promote its food? It's a very good question. How on earth do you have millions of people visiting the country and they return back to their home nations still unaware of what Moroccan cuisine is meant to be all about?
I think the country is responsible, but also the communities. I think why Moroccan cuisine is so well known in France or Belgium is because there's a huge community. And in the UK, we don't have a big Moroccan community. So I think it's also the responsibility of the people to make it mainstream and accessible to other people and just spread the love for that. And definitely the country should help too.
Najee, so many of the food, the chefs or restaurateurs or cookbook writers that we talk to here at Monocle, they always talk to me at least about memory and how food is all bound up with memory. And we know that smells and tastes are the most powerful things that stimulate that. And it's interesting, right from the top, you talked about your heritage and your parents sort of continuing these memories from Morocco via Belgium to here. Why do you think food is... I mean, obviously, we need food to survive fundamentally, but there is something incredible, isn't there, about how it taps into the memories, how it can conjure these amazing images of other places. It's almost uniquely powerful, right, in being able to do that.
And I totally agree. I think, food is very connected to nostalgia, I think, and that's why we crave something, and when we eat it, we're so satisfied. And it might not be the best thing on earth, but just because you had that nostalgia of what it brought you when you were 5 years old, then you're going to love that dish. And I think there's so many things that, for instance, my mom's one of her favorite things to eat is the yogurt she used to eat when she was 5 years old. And it's like one of the most simple things you can have on earth. But she just loved that taste because it reminds her of her childhood in Fez in Morocco. So I think we're all like, we all have inner child inside us and we have our favorite meals and they remind us of time we used to love.
So what kind of food are you thinking about when you think of something that takes you back to your childhood?
One of the recipes that's in my book, it's the chicken tagine with preserved lemons and olives. Yeah, every time, when I left my parents' place, every time I would come back home, that would be what's for dinner. Because my mom knew how much I loved that dish and it's one of my favorite dishes.
Let me ask you, you talked about sort of making Moroccan food more accessible, helping people to understand it better. What's the sort of gateway food? Because there's some complexity. You need to be quite patient to cook a good tagine, maybe. Is there a sort of a really, really easy thing that like anybody can try? You mentioned you can buy the ingredients now almost anywhere. What would be the easiest thing to make people aware of the magic that lies this way?
Well, it's a very simple answer, but most of the recipes in my book are really easy. Most of them won't take more than 1 hour or an hour and a half. And I think my book is 90% easy recipe, and it really reflects the way I cook, because I'm a very lazy cook and I love to take shortcuts. Because I like to give recipes, because it's home cooking, and I like to give recipes at work and recipes that people can make and look at and don't be unmotivated when they look at them, because
what
I think
about changing. Are you one of those? I sense that you are, and from the tone of the book, that you would sort of encourage people to maybe, you know, make changes, do their own thing as well. Is that part of the process?
Definitely. There's a story in my book where I say that the first time I came here, I ordered tagine. I went to a Moroccan restaurant, ordered a tagine, and then my tagine came with a side of couscous. And in Morocco, it never happens. Unless, you know, you've been to Marrakesh and touristy places. If you go, you eat the tagine in Morocco, it will be served with bread. That's how we eat it. And my first reaction was, I felt very uncomfortable. And I was like, maybe I'm betraying my culture. Maybe I shouldn't do this. And then I thought, okay, let's just try it. I'm in London. It's fine. And I loved it. And that's when I realized that food is evolution. And if you want to, you know, if you want food to become more popular, you just need to accept that things are going to be a little bit more different. But if you do it the right way, then you always have those flavors and the soul of the food and what makes it special. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Do you see some kind of evolution taking place in Morocco when it comes to Moroccan food?
Yes, I think it's happening in Morocco. There's more and more places that try to promote modern Moroccan food and cuisine. And even around the world, there's one very famous restaurant in San Francisco, and it's the only Michelin star, the only Moroccan restaurant that has a Michelin star. So, and it's very modern food. It's Moroccan food, but it's extremely modern. So I'm sure there's things happening in the world to make Moroccan food more modern, but One way to make it happen, I think, is to also make it happen at home, in people's home, and bring those flavors to their kitchen. And then they will be able to eat it more often in a restaurant and not look at it as just a very special night to have something that reminds them of Marrakesh.
Do you think that there's a risk that when there are restaurants catering for people who don't necessarily know Moroccan food, then it goes, you know, all into stereotypes, and then what this restaurant actually offers is just a massive cliché?
The stereotype restaurant or touristy restaurant are very nice and they offer an experience that can be unique and enjoyable. But I think we also need more places that are more mainstream and simple, where we can just have a tagine and not maybe the belly dancer in the background. Just be able to look at this food as something we can eat every day because it's healthy and very nutritive and just good for you.
Now, just let me ask you about the reaction that you get, actually, especially if you go to Morocco, because we talked already about there's an amazing sort of Moroccan diaspora, you know, via Belgium and France, around the globe, in fact. Are you sort of viewed with, I don't know, is there a sense of pride? Do you get that you're sort of, the message is out there? Or is there sometimes a little suspicion that because your approach is a bit different, it's informed also by Belgian cuisine and culture as well? What's the reaction when you go back to Morocco?
The majority of the people are very excited. And actually, they say that it's great that I'm promoting our country through food. Obviously, you have very traditionalist people who don't like change and think that, you know, you should eat your tagine with bread and things like that. And also, I don't mind that. I think everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but the majority of the people are very excited because at the end of the day, you know, promoting our country, it's a beautiful place and I'll keep doing it as long as I can.
Could you tell us what you would like people to actually discover when it comes to Moroccan food? What kind of treasures do you have over there that people still don't know of?
I think they don't know the variety of salad that we have that are similar to medzay in Middle Eastern cuisine. So we also have our own way to have a medzay, and we have so many different kinds of salads that are so tasty and amazing. And my book has two veggie chapters. The first one, because, and most of them are just some of these salads because they're so good. Most of them are served cold. You can have something that's from chicken liver till a very carrot salad with herbs and olives. So there's a very huge variety. And what we do in Morocco is we serve them depending on the season and what's available. There's also something that I think people are starting to know more now called zeylouk. And it's a version of, it's like baba ganoush or mutabbel, and it's with aubergine. And it's so good. It has cumin and lots of spices. It's one of my favorite ones.
Let me ask you about maybe the most sort of evocative thing. We already talked about food and memory and where, how food can transport you anywhere in the world. Is there a dish and maybe a moment in your life that is the perfect sort of embodiment? You've already talked about your childhood and things that your mum makes. Is there sort of one moment that sums up your sort of foodie passion the best, perhaps? It's hard to choose one, of course.
Yeah, I would definitely say pastilla. The chicken pastilla, for me, it's the essence of Moroccan cooking. It's not a dish that's well known. It's, again, it's a dish that I would love to become, to make more popular. And it's a chicken phyllo pie, essentially, but it's so good. And it's made with layers of onion confit, chicken, scrambled eggs, and roasted nuts. And it's sweet and savory, it's crunchy, and it's Morocco on the plate, literally. It's one of my favorite dishes.
Listeners may be able to hear, that's probably my stomach rumbling with all these delicious items that are being described.
Just finally, Nargis, the book is out now, Casablanca, My Moroccan Food. You're still writing your blog as well. How does your mission to make people more aware of Moroccan cuisine continue?
I think anything that I can do to promote Moroccan food, I will do. Like sitting here today is one way to do it. Writing my book, continuing my blog, collaborating with other foodies. So many things that I have lined up for the coming months, and I'm very excited about them. And I hope I'll be able to do it as long as it's possible.
Good luck with the journey. We hope that it continues for a very long time. As Marcus says, the delicious Casablanca, My Moroccan Food, is out in all good bookshops now. Nargis, thanks for coming to see us.
Thanks for having me. It was lovely.
Marcus, I think all that chat has made me hungry for music. How about a tune?
I agree with your suggestion. What shall we have?
Well, we're going to be hearing from the musician Josh T. Pearson in just a moment. So let's have a track from his new record, The Straight Hits. This is Straight At Me.
Hang my reputation out to dry. I don't care at all.
Josh T. Pearson there with Straight At Me, and we'll be hearing from him just after this.
Musician Josh T. Pearson first made an impact back in 2001 with his first band, Lift, to experience his seminal record, The Texas Jerusalem Crossroads. It was a sprawling spiritual ode to his homeland, the Lone Star State, containing equal amounts of myth and good humour.
He followed it up with acoustic solo album Last of the Country Gentlemen, voted Rough Trade's Album of the Year back in 2011, and he returns this year with another stylistic about-turn, a stripped down country-influenced new album The Straight Hits, and having released all of three albums over a 20-year career, there may be some humour in that title too.
Just maybe. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall met Josh to talk about it. Tom began by asking him whether the latest record is a new departure or a natural evolution.
Fast as a bullet, aim by gosh, shooting for stars, cannot be stopped.
As far as recorded music, it's definitely seen as a departure, I guess, but my buddy says something sort of funny about me. Josh T. Pearson, once you get to know him, he's a nice bunch of guys. I grew up playing rock and roll and psychedelic music, so it's just that the one solo record I happened to commit to tape was Death Folk acoustic album, so...
People are calling it a departure, but you say that...
Who's calling it? Where are they?
I don't know. I think the general mood around the release, it feels like something different.
Yeah, it's a little different.
Yeah, but, you know, this is something that you've been doing all your life, and it's not so much of a departure for you.
The thing that would be accurate about that is it's silly and playful, and there's not a lot of subtext. It was written quickly, immediately, to kind of get straight to the point. And kind of frivolous. I wrote it in 3 days as a practice after coming off of a long writing period of another piece of music. And I kind of wanted, just as a personal challenge, to see if my time had improved in the writing process. I said, well, let's see how quick it is. And then I went back and revisited the love song because it kind of followed the fifth rule. I needed to submit to what that song was asking me for. That's the one on the record I'd be really proud of as far as time investment. I'm so grateful just for who you are. I'm so damn grateful just for who you are. And I mean, what is it in your life that made you want to make a record in that way? I mean, what have things changed since? I mean, it's been a long time since the last of the Country Gentlemen. I mean, what's changed in your life that would sort of inspire you to work in that way? Well, I think part of it, kind of burning down the old idols or images. Various changes in my lifestyle over the last 6-7 years of, let's say, toward recovery or happiness, choosing life and getting healthy and exercise, diet and exercise, things that you finally make a conscious decision to go toward.
That is something that everyone, including myself, as you get through your life, you start to realize that exercise is a real thing, and a healthy body can actually work towards a healthy mind. Is that something that you kind of now subscribe to?
Yeah. I mean, I had so much baggage growing up with self-defeating and annihilation, shooting myself in the foot, feeling you don't deserve to feel good, et cetera, because your old sense of self-worth is pretty worthless. But finally making a conscious choice to actively pursue health really has radically transformed disposition. And you have to do maintenance, you know, as you're getting older anyway, and it's really life or death, and the headspace just gets darker and darker. So, yeah, that helped.
And then at the end of it, you have a very brisk, energetic new album. I'm sure it's not intrinsically linked, but it is a nice side effect. I guess
that's what allowed me the position to release something I never would, because it always had to be so heavy-handed before.
You were talking about not feeling so much pressure to make an album, but you have put restrictions on yourself, as in, I mean, and they're playful ones maybe, but every song on the album has the word straight in it, straight to the top, straight at me, give it to me straight, because each one has that sort of wordplay in it.
So. Well, I need it straight and to the point, and I'm also very concerned about the robot takeover and see a great divide coming. We'll have to choose between enhancement or being left behind, so I thought it was part of my hidden agenda, which I didn't really need to talk about here, but to have the letters AI in the center of the word so that I can point to it 15 years from now, 20 years from now, when it starts to get interesting, if it does. I think it's something we should definitely be talking about, though.
Well, to me, it jumped out at me also when you said that you had the word USA in the middle of Jerusalem, in the Texas-Jerusalem crossroads.
Yeah, you're good. He's done his homework.
Yeah, that's well, right. You know.
There's a great little TED Talk by Sam Harris that kind of deals with that. And if you can watch that little TED Talk for me, that'd be about the only time I need to spend on that soapbox.
It's a very real thing with all the stuff about Facebook and stuff coming out. And
yeah.
People not being able to choose because they're being supplied adverts, which they don't have any choice over.
Yeah. Information bias. It's a predicament we're in right now. And it's tricky. It's new territory, new waters. We've never been to this point. in civilization. I mean, not that we have record of course, but I'm very concerned where it's headed and that some serious choices will be made and that we really may be in the death rattles of mankind, creating our own gods that'll kill us. But yeah, that's probably all I got to say about that right now. But
they're really convenient.
Yeah, it's so much fun. You bite the apple, you know. Once you bite the apple, you can't. There's no going back. I can't. There's no going back to coach, you know.
Yeah.
How can I turn down biscuits and gravy?
Damn straight. Damn you, Hank. Damn you, Jones. Damn you straight. Damn you, Hank. But most of all, damn you, Jones.
I've never been proactive with my art. It's always been really, you know, self-limiting, I guess, or challenging, demanding of the listener what few listeners I got. So this is the first time, well, I'm going to actively will it forward where I want people, as many people to listen as possible.
Yeah.
The vinyl looks awesome. Looks
it does.
Great.
Pink vinyl.
You couldn't use a little more pink in their lives, you know?
And
I'll tell you this.
Okay.
If I could, if I can get on my other soapbox, the changes, departure in my life, just getting a haircut and after wearing a long beard for 15 years straight, you know, lots of, it's not like this cute little hipster beard. It was a pretty serious commitment. But cutting it off, seeing your face for the first time, my whole 30s, I never even saw my face. So some of those changes were difficult, but the one that was the most was kind of was switching over to color. That was super hard for me after being this kind of goth cowboy my whole life.
Yeah.
Or ever since, at least, I don't know, junior high when you start, you're listening to Smiths and stuff, and black is what you wear on the outside because black is how you feel on the inside, you know?
I mean this as a serious question.
Do it. Ask me.
Yeah. Did it feel different to have an enormous beard 15 years ago?
Absolutely.
Than it does today?
Because, well, yeah,
as you say, it's been adopted
huge,
by the
huge
hipster
cultural group. Shift, man. It was like,
what did it mean 15 years ago for you to do that?
Madmen, homeless people, that was it. You're just a madman, or homeless, or some sort of religious nutcase.
This is the story of the three Texas boys, busy minding their own business, when the angel of the Lord appeared unto them, saying, when the Winston Churchill start firing their Winston rifles into the sky, from the Lone Star State, drinking the Lone Star beer and smoking their Winston cigarettes, know the time is drawing nigh when the sun shall be lifted on high. We told them that didn't sound very Sunday go to meeting. What do you expect, they said, when God calls on the crippled, deaf, and blind to lead the children of Israel into the promised land? Children of Israel, we asked, don't your boys know nothing? The USA is the center of Jerusalem.
Where do you think the tipping point was? When did it become something you no longer could be a part of?
Well, I think it probably shifts every however long in culture anyway.
The beard continuum.
Yeah.
It's a cycle.
Something else I was going to say about that. I don't know. I mean, it shifted in America first. I remember being over here for a couple of years and going back and like, we have beards. Like, that's weird. I mean, they grow on you.
You're not known for writing, you know, condensed 3-minute pop songs, but yeah. I wanted to ask you, if you were going to pick maybe 3 of your greatest hits, which ones are your favorites of your songs, you know, throughout the last sort of 15 years?
I think none of them have been released. The Cat's Meow, Still Born to Rock. Man, those are heavy hitters. And I actually like this one I wrote in this, I mean, management's going to hate this, but one in that three-day period about a redneck who gets super drunk and ends up at the bar and has a what he calls a questionable night with another redneck dude and has what he refers to lovingly as a existential crisis. It's about 10-minute long storytelling song. I'm really proud of that work, but that hasn't come out yet either. We actually recorded it, these other comedy songs that I sure like a lot, but I think it's got a different sensibility. I don't know that British people with class and stuff will appreciate the fine nuances of controversy, the controversy we'll have to offer.
You mentioned a existential crisis, which is a great word.
I think so too. Copyrighted by JTP.
But I was curious, every song with the word straight in it, is there any connotation that people should be taking from this? Or are you just talking about pure direction? Are you talking
That's
about gender
question.
Or sexuality?
It's an interesting word because even now with the political climate so tense, even just the word straight has this, it's almost not unpolitically correct to use it. But that wasn't, no, there wasn't a lot of subtext. It was more just to get straight into the point.
Yeah.
Straight hits, it's funny, right in 3 days, bang, bang, bang. It's kind of funny because they're not all straight hits. There's some near misses, I don't know. Go so, buy it. Buy it at your local record store, straight to the top. God bless you. God bless America. Watch out for the robots.
Josh T. Pearson there, speaking to Tom Hall. Josh is on tour from this week, beginning on the 15th of May in Leeds, here in the UK, before heading to Ireland, France, Belgium and the Netherlands and beyond through to the end of the month.
You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be staying on the topic of music now, but sound combined with vision too. Matt Everett may be known to some radio fans as a voice often heard on BBC Six Music, and more keen-eared music appreciators may even know his former incarnation as a member of Britpopper's Menswear.
Now, along with illustrator Jim, is it Stoughton, Jim?
Yeah, Stoughton.
Stoughton.
Yeah, sorry, I just learned that Matt was in Menswear. I did not know that.
Didn't you know that?
That's amazing.
No, it's not. That, I mean, of all, it's not like, wow, you're in Led Zeppelin.
I used to love
Menswear. I used to play congas with LCD sound system. That would be, it's like, oh, you were in a shonky.
I can't believe that's been revealed up to you only now.
I used to love Menswear.
We were terrible.
What did you do?
I played the drums.
My goodness. Hi, I'm Jim. Nice to meet you. Didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah. This is so much better than the intro we had.
Yeah.
Can we sorry, just use this? And along with illustrator Jim Stoughton, the duo have made a new book looking at some of the best music festivals to have ever filled a field. It's called Where's My Welly? See where they're going. And amid the hundreds of famous musical faces crowding each scene, if you can't spot the welly on each page, you may end up feeling a Wally. See what I've done there.
Yep, yep.
We'll let Matt and Jim explain more. You can see Jim loved that. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, both. What a delight. Hours of time in the Monocle office this week. I was going to say wasted, but just spent poring over these delightful pictures. What's the genesis?
I don't know how it began. I think it probably began with you somehow. It didn't. Certainly didn't begin with me.
Yeah, but we, well, had the idea. The publishers talked a lot about... Interesting, as you say, you mentioned the Where's Wally concept. Mm. And being a lover of festivals and being someone that's been to festivals, I mean, the idea is to pick these festivals that are, you know, some of the most iconic and important festivals in the history of music, all for kind of different reasons. Maybe a specific performance, or maybe just the reputation or the vibe. And so we needed someone to illustrate these festivals, and not just a crowd with a welly, but a crowd of famous musicians and iconic people that were at each event, which you spot along with the welly. So we needed someone who was gullible enough to spend most of the year doing drawings of musicians, which is what James
that's where I come
said
in.
Yes to.
That's right.
Was it hard for you to pick which festivals to include in this book?
Well, again, that was down to Matt, I think. When I was approached, the book was pretty much fully formed, so all of the anecdotes for each festival was given to me straight away.
Some of them are quite obvious. You've got to have Glastonbury in there. You've got to have Woodstock. I think you've got to think about, you know, some of the big European festivals as well. It's not just about the UK and, you know, something like Bestival, which is a relatively new festival, in the Pantheon. And also the ones that had got those defining moments in them, be it sort of Daft Punk at Coachella, which was when sort of EDM music kind of got introduced to the mainstream in the US. The first one is Newport Folk Festival, which was the specific year that Bob Dylan played the electric guitar for the first time and the folk world was appalled and this was the worst thing that ever happened to anyone and he'd been traitor to the form of folk music. So that's why he's in there.
Yeah, I like that one.
And then, it was Jim trying to, rather than just be, here's a stage and here's a bunch of people, it was like, how can we make them visually interesting and how can Jim make them visually interesting?
Well, yeah, and Jim, that's what kind of intrigues me. I wonder, because that sounds like a kind of dream gig for an illustrator in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much of a kind of music aficionado you were, but did you find that you sort of had an image that immediately came into your mind of how you wanted to realise them? Or did you have to kind of go back and look at dock photographs of the time,
yeah,
read the sort of histories, or did you sort of know how you were going to tackle most of these?
Well, it's sort of a mixture of the two, really. So the brief was massive, obviously, because it was 12 festivals and then brief history for every festival and then a defining moment for each festival and then also a list of celebrities who would be in the crowd at each festival. So the brief for each double page spread was a side of A4 and a lot of history and then some very specific references from Matt about what happened and where and who was there and all of that. So when you get a brief that big, it's difficult to see it in your mind straight away, but I definitely had an idea for each spread of the angle and what I wanted to show more of. And then there was a lot of figuring out like the angle of the stage and just to make it so that it wasn't repeating itself all the way through and things
what's
like
kind
that.
Of what kind of feedback did you get from Matt?
Very positive,
yeah,
most of the time.
I'm an enormous fan.
Not all of the time.
Yeah, I'm an enormous fan of Jim's work. I don't think I've said it. It was a bit of an honour, really, to get you to do it, to
you
to say yes. Because it is, it's an epic piece of work.
I think the only one that we sketched that you had some very specific feedback about was the Nirvana spread, because I don't know anything about music festivals, and I have panic attacks at music festivals. So I had sketched this thing out, but I'd got all of the characters in the wrong, playing the wrong instruments,
yeah,
the wrong positions and things like that.
But yeah, because this is the thing. It's like because I am really boring and obsessed about music. All that kind of that's the wrong shape guitar.
That's right.
This is that he wouldn't have had a cymbal in that size.
The amplifier
was somewhere else.
I loved it. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I kind of really went in quite deep. Because also, I think, and if you're going to do these things, it's got to be.
You've got to do it right. Absolutely.
Got to do it factually, accurately, as much as possible.
Yeah.
I think so. We did get quite. We did drill in.
It was great. I really appreciated it because otherwise, you know, like I said, I wouldn't have. I wouldn't have got those details right. But you did send me a picture of the bass guitar, which was really funny.
Yeah, I know. A little bit. I was obsessing by that point as well.
Yeah, it was really good.
If you have, Matt, that slightly kind of encyclopedic knowledge and interest.
Boring, useless information.
Well, I was being more complimentary.
Okay.
Did you still find that you learned some things about some of these famous performances, particularly, you know, the big moments or the big days? Because I guess a lot of fans kind of think they know the potted history. Did you go on a voyage of discovery yourself, research?
I think the thing that became apparent the more we got into it, and obviously looking at Jim's speech, is like, festivals used to be quite, if not a niche thing, then you were a certain kind of person went to a festival, and festivals were a certain kind of thing. There was band played, you drank cider, you had a terrible dog burger, and you stayed in a rubbish tent, and you watched the same kind of bands. But looking at this, it's like, it's become so much of a part of social history. More people apply for tickets for Glastonbury than apply for tickets for Wimbledon. And it's like, that's not just applying to go and sit in the stands. That's actually, I'm going to spend 6 days...
taking part.
Taking part. Mm. And that, I think, says a lot about the kind of people that we are. You know, we engage in music in a really personal way. We want to see these. We want to share these experiences. And seeing how long we've been doing it since the 60s, you know, there's a reason, because they can be awful. The toilets are awful. The queuing is terrible. The car parks are terrible. Sometimes some of the music's not very good. And the food can be better. It's an effort. It's a lot of work going to a festival.
I have to say, you're describing all of the reasons I don't go to them.
But the things that are amazing about them are so amazing that you kind of ignore those things year after year after year after year after year.
So, Matt, what makes a great festival then?
Oh, indefinable, isn't it? It's the mix of...
magic.
Magic, yeah. The music's got to be great, but I'd go to Glastonbury even if the music was... I didn't like any of the artists. It's the communal nature. You know, if someone falls over, someone else picks you up. That thing, I think, is really important. And the idea of a self-governing group of people that look after each other and we're there for the same reasons. We're like-minded people. We appreciate music and creativity and there's a tolerance there, which I think is that's a good thing. It's the best of us.
I did go to see one gig at a festival that was pretty amazing. I went to see Death in Vegas at V97, I think.
Yeah.
And the sun was setting just as it was getting really intense. And ordinarily, I would have had a panic attack and fainted. But there was just something about... everyone was kind of just still and listening and watching the sun, and it was pretty amazing.
Well, and the weather plays an incredible role because you're dealing with something that is... I mean, that's serendipity if you get a moment. I'll do one. I went to Hop Farm. It's a smaller one in Kent.
Yeah.
Neil Young was playing. Refreshments and what else had been taken. But nevertheless, it had been rained terribly. And then suddenly... the clouds God parted. Appeared. A beam of light falls. Now, you can't script that. You can't stage that.
That's not going to happen again. It's not, you can, you, even if you watch it, it's not going to be like.
I don't think it actually did happen.
You know, but like that is. Yeah. I had this amazing band played. One of the first Glastonbury's I ever went to, and I think the Orb were headlining Ambient Soundscape Masters, and drinks had been taken, and I think we just watched a warm-up DJ on a different stage for hours, thinking it was the Orb. They're like, oh, that was good, wasn't it? They played for us. Yeah, that wasn't. They were playing somewhere else.
They played.
They were great. The visuals were good. No, that was just a tent.
Good words to that test song.
Exactly.
Test.
So, but that's the thing, isn't it?
That's amazing. Sorry, I was just going to ask about the first festival you actually remember attending. Was it that one, or was it something earlier? What kind of thing was that, and what do you remember from there?
It was Reading Festival, which is covered in this book. I think we cover the second year Nirvana played. It was 89, 88, I think I went. I think New Order played. And it was like I was saying, it was quite grotty. There wasn't any yurts. There wasn't any glamping. There wasn't any. Like, you go to the other. There's a very nice couscous stand over here, and you can get a nice paella. None of that. It was giant Yorkshire pudding with a sausage in the middle of it.
Yes.
That's it.
But
days.
Those things have changed. And it's funny, you're talking about Glastonbury. I go for the community. Do you think, because everyone talks about it, and it's a bit of a lazy thing really to talk about, the corporatization of it, and it's become, you know, a money making machine and all the rest. Is there something that you do miss from the old stripped down days? Okay, maybe it was a bit shonky and everything was horrible, and is there something more charming? I don't know, it's proof of people's commitment to the cause, or do you just think that was horrible, this is better? Why worry?
I'm 45 now, so I like to have linen in my sleeping situation. I would rather not lie on, just like a damp towel and not take my jeans off for 4 days anymore.
Well, you should never come and stay at my place. that's what would be on offer.
But if you want to run rampage after your GCSEs and just lose the plot and meet strange people from strange
areas,
you still can. And you know, but that's the point, I think. People go to different festivals for different reasons. I think Reading is about going bananas when you're 17.
So if you could choose maybe two or three festivals from this book you would have wanted to attend, which ones would you go for?
I would choose Newport. That's the one with Dylan, right?
Yeah,
I would choose that one. And I would probably choose Woodstock with Hendrix.
But the thing is, with Woodstock, I do get the feeling that the reality wasn't quite as amazing.
I think that's why I would choose it, because it's that thing, isn't it? I spoke to my mum recently about, she was born in 56 and she grew up in the, you know, she went through the 60s and the 70s, and her story of the 60s and 70s is very different from what I've been led to believe was going on.
Like what?
Just nothing, really.
Nothing happened.
Just, you know, kind of went to school, grew up, got a job, met your dad, you know, and had you. So I would want to see, you know, where all those stories and that atmosphere from that period of time, where does that come from? Because it must come from somewhere, but I've got a feeling it was a relatively small scene than what we've been led to believe. Yeah. And then I would seek it out and get in there if I had enough time.
It's like people talk about punk. It's like, oh, punk was this amazing movement. It's like for about 250 people in London, everyone else in Wolverhampton was just going to work.
It was
coming back home and having some fish fingers. That's all that happened. There wasn't a great seismic cultural tearing up of the rule book.
Wasn't there a disco crossover as well?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, like
I only know that from films.
People, it's history is not always. You remember the exciting things, isn't it? History is written by the winners.
Well,
that's
interesting. And I wonder, I guess this book and these illustrations, they are kind of dreamlike, and there's a sort of reverie quality, and you get lost in the detail, looking for the wellies and all the rest of it. But that is a bit of a thing with festivals, isn't it, Matt, this idea of the legend. It's like you talk about gigs, and there's the famous, there's this gig that everyone said they were at, and then you look at the thing, there was only 100 people there.
And they had a terrible time.
And they can't have done. But does that make it? Is it part of it, that legend writing, the kind of the fables, the mythologizing of it?
I think so. It's that thing to be able to say, oh, yeah, I was there. When you listen to Mick Hucknall talk about the first Sex Pistols gig, you've got to respect him for, you know, he's one of 12 people. So I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, because you make your own mythology when you're there, because the normal rules tend to sort of get suspended at festivals. You know, you don't have any responsibilities necessarily, or you certainly not responsibilities like you do in your ordinary day-to-day life.
One would hope.
You can wear what you want, you can do what you want. Nobody will come up and ask you to sort a spreadsheet out about the next things you have to do. And actually, they might do, but anyway.
It depends.
You enter a sort of place that is, you're sort of building your own mythology, aren't you? You're entering a place unlike your normal life. Even the most mundane-looking, ordinary kind of festivals have that element where it's like all normal rules are off.
It's the same for just periods of time, though, in music and fashion and culture. I mean, it all gets distilled down to the best bits, doesn't it? It does sort of make you wonder what the hell people are going to say about now in 20 years' time, because as far as I can tell, the best things are all things that are being
rehashed
from 20 years ago. So, you know, maybe a black hole will form.
Exactly. I was just going to ask about that. When we talk about mythology, I see that the latest festival you have featured in this book is from 2016. Do you think this era of mobile phones and mobile phone cameras and social media is ruining something for us? Do you think the kind of music history, festival history is still being made today as what we see from the pages of this book?
I think, yes. Lots of people talked about this year's Coachella Festival and saying it was more about Instagrammable events than it was long performances. So people would turn up and watch, like, someone come on stage, all guns blazing, lights, production, take a couple of pictures, go, I've experienced that now.
Right.
And then nick off and go do something else. So you're like, but hang on, that was one bit of this artist has planned, like, 45 minutes of expression and music, and you don't care about that. You care about just that little moment. It's a curse and a blessing having phones at festivals.
Yeah.
Because it's really useful to ever find yourself and find other people. Mm-hmm. But then again,
I didn't think you were going to say that.
It was also it's kind of a shame, because then you don't get properly lost anymore. Mm. You know, I mean, I guess you can do, but, and also the rumours have stopped. But you go to a festival, and then because you weren't in contact with the outside world, you'd hear like, Terry Wogan's died.
Yeah.
That would be the one when I was growing up, that would happen. Or like, oh, the Queen's had a heart attack. I do remember being at the Glastonbury that Michael Jackson did actually die, and no one thinking it was true.
Oh, wow.
Michael Jackson's dead. No, he's not. He's fine. No, he's actually dead. No, he's not. And now, of course, the information is just everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's taken some of the unpredictability.
But then I suppose if you do happen to see something truly amazing, I suppose those moments are rarer now, aren't they? Because there's more options, more gigs, more festivals, yeah, more things to see. So when you do see something that really sort of chills you and makes you want to be sick with excitement, it's kind of more exciting because you know the chances of seeing something like that are reduced, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
But things look rubbish on the phones. So, like, someone's like, oh, I went to go to see Beyonce and she was amazing. Let's have a look. Oh, look at the phone. Mm. Or just even on the screen.
She's very small.
Just like, it's not very good.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's taking away, like the Christmases you remember when you were a kid, when there was hardly any photos, probably. Mm. I have a patina of, like, a memory of magic that you don't get now if you look at other, when there's just loads of pictures and it's everywhere. It's sometimes, like wedding videos.
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah, wedding videos are never as good as the wedding. Don't forget about the video.
Well, that's what they say about memory. I was listening to something recently that talked about memory being an act of creation. So every memory you had, brain people, first of all, thought that there was a part of your brain that you would access a memory from, and it was in there, fully formed, and you would access it and view it.
Like a cupboard.
Yeah, exactly, like a drawer full of stuff. And now they come to realise that whenever you remember something, it's an act of creation, and you create it every time. So
really? The
more you remember something, the less accurate it is. So they used the...
I can't remember.
No. They they used an elephant on a barbecue. No, they didn't. That was a made-up... they used the analogy of a first kiss. So if you kiss someone for the first time and then suffered from amnesia and lost your memory entirely, that memory would be perfect because you would never be able to recount it. Whereas if you recount it, it is less accurate the more that you remember it.
That's why these phones are
terrible, aren't they? Because you don't need to work to remember something. You just go and watch it.
That's why you're ruining stupider.
You're ruining your
mind,
memory, your imagination, your creativity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ruining your imagination. That's worrying, isn't it?
Yeah.
God.
Wow.
Which is why this book is so important.
Exactly. I was going to say, we were decrying the fact that people can't get lost anymore, yeah, but they can get lost in the beautiful pages of...
Well, that's why we made it.
Yeah. Where's My Welly World's greatest music festival challenge. Its creators are Matt Everett and Jim Stoughton. Matt, Jim, wonderful to meet you. Thanks for coming to
Very good to meet you too.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you very much. Well, Tom, that was a very inspirational show. There was some music festivals, some Moroccan food, music. What else could you hope for?
Everything you could possibly need of a Sunday, Marcus.
Do you think you'll be going to music festivals this summer now after that chat?
Well, I'm going to have to, I've got too many kids dragging around.
I know, that happens when you choose that path in your life. And I think it's all for this edition of the Monocle Weekly, by the way.
On that note, it's time for the curtain to drop. Let's thank the people who made the programme. It was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them both.
For now, it's goodbye from me, Marcos Hippi.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.